Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast. Welcome to the channel, and thanks very, very much for joining us today. I just got off the Skype phone with Mingwei Song to talk about his new book, Young China, National Rejuvenation and the Bildungsroman, 1900 to 1959. This came out with the Harvard University Asia Center in 2016, and it is such a rich and such an interesting book. So what the book does is take us through the kind of emergence, transformation, and symbolic meanings of youth in the context of Chinese literature and its engagement with social and political transformation and individual transformation in the first half of the 20th century. Now, what it does is it takes us through particular works that embody these concerns and these transformations. And these works include novels of various sorts, some you will have heard of, some you will not have heard of. And in the course of our conversation, you'll hear us talking in broad terms about them. But if you go and look at the pages of the book, you'll find all kinds of detail, really, really interesting and gripping detail about the protagonists, the heroines, the heroes, the other characters in these books and in these short stories, and the way that they are transforming, the way those transformations speak to and speak from concerns with youth, old and new youth, rejuvenation, and how those transformations and this historical transformation in conceptions of youth that Mingwei is bringing us to speak to not just how we can, should, might understand youth as a concept more generally, but also how we might as readers understand ourselves as youths, regardless of how old we are, regardless of how we self-identify in terms of chronological age. So it's really fascinating. By the end of it, you'll hear us getting to Chinese science fiction. So definitely stay tuned for that. It's one of my favorite stories of the whole book is the epilogue story that we talk about of this kind of micro world. And you'll hear that in the hour to come. So in the meantime, thank you very much for listening. Thanks for your support of the channel, and I hope you enjoy. I'm here today to talk with Mingwei Song about his new book, Young China. Welcome to the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast, Mingwei, and thanks not only for writing an exceptionally rich and beautifully wrought and beautifully written book about a really fascinating topic, but also for making time to talk with me about it today. I'm really looking forward and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Carla, for inviting me to the program.
Of course. So, Mingwei, let's start, as is traditional for the channel, with the first question. How did you come to work on China and to work on modern Chinese literature specifically as your field of academic inquiry?
When I looked back at my career development, when I was in college, I was actually more interested in Western literature, and I did some work in comparative literature. But what really got me into the study in modern Chinese literature was a project that I was commissioned to do when I was a senior in college. That was to actually pretty big project for me at that time. That was to write a book about Eileen Chang. That was 1994, 1 year before she passed away. At that time, I was just one of the many admirers of her talent, her work. I was chosen by a Taiwan publisher to write this book. I was doing that, and when I was halfway through that, we heard that Eileen Chang passed away. That eventually turned into the first comprehensive study of her life and work, written in Chinese. And that also changed my route, basically changed my career, the direction of my career development. Eventually led me to be more and more interested in modern Chinese literature.
Mm-hmm. Great. So the book that we are talking about today, in the words of the book, aims to investigate the discursive construction of youth's symbolic meanings, and also to explore how those meanings underlie the novelistic narrative of modern Chinese youth's personal development. So this is a book about modern China, about the modern Chinese novel, about youth in its various instantiations, and we're going to explore those different resonances and meanings in the hour to come. But first, how did you come to this particular project? What brought you to this focus for your research on this project?
The first idea for something like this, at that time, I was not expecting to write a book. I was just writing an article. That was 1999. I was still in China, in Shanghai. Around 1997 to 1999, 2000, that was the time when a new generation of Chinese writers, who were usually recognized the writers born in the 1970s, to whom I belong, actually, they begin to make some impact on the literary scene, and people were talking about them. There were novels, very popular novels like Shanghai Baby or Mian Mian's Candy. So when I was trying to do some critical reflection on this phenomena, I noticed that growing up or coming of age was really a major theme for these writers. Perhaps for each generation, there was this very important theme about coming of age that I later discovered, actually. But at that time, I was writing this article, this critical review of some of the representative works of this generation. I found one problem, actually, that was, these short stories, these novellas, these novels about growing up, but there is a sort of a lack of psychological growth at the center of the narrative. Usually youth is taken for granted, or the charm of youth or the power of youth is taken for granted without much reflection on how it is characterized, how it is developed. That was really the beginning of the project. Later, when I came to study in the United States, I sort of broadened my my research area. I began to feel interested in the earlier 10 periods, the Republican period, and then eventually the Qing. So I sort of moved from the very contemporary toward earlier, toward the transition from tradition to modernity, and begin to sort of trace the genealogy of the youth discourse. So that one question about my sort of the writings of my own generation eventually brought me to several generations, to the situation several generations ago, to the generation of Liang Qichao, who first conceived the idea of Young China to make youth a powerful troop in his advocacy for a Young China project for the sort of a modern reform. So So that was the background and how I came to this topic. And when I was studying at Columbia University, I was under the guidance of Professor David Wang, mm-hmm. and I was also taking classes in some Western literature subjects. And eventually I found the Bildungsroman, this German idea for, I knew that before, but in America studied more of this idea. I found it's very helpful concept for me to study the narrative about youth, or I'm not taking it as a sort of a monolithic idea, but rather a monolithic system, or rather it's complicated, it's full of tensions, it's full of different views on what is the Bildung, what is the culture, what is the education. And there's also the irony, self-irony in the system, in the discourse, in the narrative. So I began to work on that to do a PhD dissertation, and the PhD dissertation mainly covered the studies in the novel. So that's how I begin. Yeah.
Great. So when you changed, when you sat down or stood up or whatever position you were in when you did this, but when you decided to change the dissertation into a book, so you've already said a little bit about the focus of the dissertation. Were there any other notable aspects of that transformative process, turning the dissertation into the book, that were notable, any major transformations in how you were thinking about and conceptualizing the project from one form to the other?
Mm-hmm. The dissertation is more about the Bildungsroman, this form of narrative, and it's more based on close reading. It's more based on the analysis of the literary works. When I was beginning to turn the dissertation into a book project, I was thinking of situating or contextualizing this literary image in the larger culture history, in the background of a larger history, historical background about how the youth discourse was initiated, was developed, was sometimes combined with other things. So this investigation went a little bit toward historical aspect and the terminology and the investigation of the discourse. Very much the earlier chapters were completely rewritten when I was revising the dissertation, when I was reorienting my research.
Great. So let's get right into it. Let's get right into the book. Mm-hmm. So the first chapter lays a foundation for the rest of the book by introducing the youth discourse of modern China and the Bildungsroman, as you've just been talking about, in the Chinese context. Now, this chapter asks a crucial and deceptively simple question. What does mm-hmm. it mean to be young? When we say young or youth, what do we actually mean? And you remind us here in this chapter that youth is a discursive construction, and it always involves not just construction, but some sort of reconstruction or deconstruction, right? And this is, I think, really important to keep in mind. Now, you bring us into the discursive construction of youth in the Chinese context by introducing the symbolic ideal of the green spring. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is probably a good place to start. What do we need to know to understand what you think is most important about this discursive construction of the green spring as we move forward from this to the other parts of the book?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I think the most important change for the youth discourse, because I want to emphasize that youth or in the Chinese, 青年 or 青春 or 少年, it's not a completely new term. It has some archaic implications in classical Chinese literature, but actually it was always changing in the literary tradition of pre-modern China. But toward the late Qing, when the generation of Liang Qichao began to invention a new China, they used the term 少年 or youth to envision something radically different, that is radically different from the tradition. So that is when this image of youth began to have a greater meaning than originally phrased in classical Chinese literature. It began to be combined with a very strong political idealism about the change. This sort of a change means the change that is established toward building a different future. So the idea about youth is something in the biological development of a person's life is no longer there. What Liang Qichao and later Chen Duxiu did was to emphasize the meaning of youth to such extent that youth can be sort of like standing on its own. The youth does not need to grow up or grow into a mature person. Youth itself is the end. So that is a central idea about what I mean by modern form. But that said, in this chapter, what I did is actually to look at the claims, but also to look at the claims of these cultural reformers, but also look at their background, their more like what they wrote, what they wrote over a long range of time. I realized that youth is not that new. And for example, for Liang Qichao, this idea of a 少年中国 is also built upon the strengths of tradition. So for him, he often used some traditional trope to emphasize the dynamics of youth. And in Liang Qichao's cultural project, he's not just talking about the reform. He also wants to keep the Confucian tradition alive. So there's a sense of a rejuvenation, that is to make the tradition rejuvenated. So it's not about completely towards the future, but also about how to make the past really lively, really a part of the ongoing project in the present. So that made this Chinese discourse on youth very interesting, because at that time, in the 19th century, in the late 19th century, early 20th century, youth is a worldwide phenomenon. It's everywhere people were talking about young Italy that actually inspired Liang Qichao through the Japanese translation, but also the young Poland, this young America. Everywhere is sort of like a young nation movement. But for many of those nationalist projects, youth is about something really that is really new, about to establish a new identity. But for Liang Qichao, it's not that simple. He wanted to rejuvenate the old Chinese idea of
This is actually great because it also really nicely leads us into what's happening in the next chapter, which is very much related to this idea of rejuvenation and national rejuvenation or other sorts of rejuvenation. That's not just a matter of embracing the new, but also revitalizing the old. And in the next chapter, you introduce the figure of the old youth. So chapter 2 looks at the late Qing trend that attempted to, in the words of the book, rewrite the archaic tradition into modernity. So this very much speaks to what you were just saying. And you focus in particular on Wu Jianren's The New Story of the Stone. Now you talk here about the way that Wu Jianren uses the figure of the old youth as a symbol of late Qing negotiations between tradition and modernity. So can you tell us a little bit about that briefly? What do you think is most important as a takeaway for us about this figure of the old youth there?
Old youth, this idea, I borrowed from the Wu Jianren's novel, The New Story of the Stone, this idea of the old youth. But I also saw some complications, some irony in this. So there are also meanings that are not completely found in this novel, but I explained in the context of the youth movement in the late Qing and in 20th century China. Actually, this image, old youth, or Lao Shao Nian, is a character in this novel, The New Story of the Stone. He's the tour guide for Jia Baoyu, who was also revived, or he was rejuvenated through some sort of a time traveling into the future, first into the present, then into the future. And the old youth is the person he met when he traveled to the future land. And this old youth, he appear to be actually in the novel he's not youth, he's just called himself old youth, but he's more like a middle-aged man, but when he revealed his age, that was quite astonishing. He was already I forgot 100 something, you know, really more than 100 years old, but his appearance was not that old. He was very energetic. He was learning all sorts of new things, and he passed those new ideas and new things to Jia Baoyu. And through Lao Shaonian's introduction, Jia Baoyu also met some other characters in the novel, and it turns out that in this future civilized realm of this Wenming Jingjie, there are quite a lot of the old people who remain to be energetic, or at least they do not look like old people. So this idea is very much rooted in Wu Jianren as well as Liang Qichao and many of their contemporaries' idea about the revitalization of a tradition. So the tradition won't simply grow old when it's already like modern time, when it receives a lot of criticism, but rather the invention, the tradition to be fully re-energized, sort of revitalized, rejuvenated, so they could build a more concrete identity for the nation on the national rejuvenation, this idea of a national rejuvenation. So that's the meaning, I think, very much to be found in the novel. But also pay attention to this this, of course, very important figure, Jia Baoyu. He himself is another sort of old youth, because he's also from the past. He traveled to the future world, but he himself actually carries over to their this familiar image of his character from traditional Chinese literature. But it's also a very important aspect about Jia Baoyu in his travels in the future world, because he cannot really participate in the work in the future. He's sort of alienated. He's an outsider in the progress of history. So he feels he's denied the entrance into the construction of this future. So for him, youth is rather a burden. Youth is rather a part of his identity that he cannot overcome. So he's not like the other characters who are so sort of called old youth, but they are really appear to be old. They are already part of the history. But Jia Baoyu is more like youth, but his youth is a sort of like a waste unto its own. It's not part of the working toward making youth the energy or the manpower toward historical progress. So in this case, there's quite some kind of like a self-irony here about the displacement, about the misidentity of the youth part in the old youth. So here's basically some sort of a dilemma I found in the image of the old youth. On the one hand, this idea sort of serves to bridge tradition and modernity. It presents sort of like a very smooth combination of the two parts. But on the other hand, there's really a gap there, showing that the youth can be something left out in this historical movement from tradition toward modernity.
Thank you so much. So that is the focus of much of the chapter, but then the late part of the chapter, and I'll just mention this for listeners before we move on so they know kind of what to find here. The late part of the chapter also considers the way that social changes reshaped the experiences of Chinese youth from the late Qing to the early Republic, and looks at how these are connected to components of this Chinese Bildungsroman that we were talking about mm-hmm. earlier. So young people are receiving a new style education, the Chinese educational system is being modernized, modern student movements are emerging, and you mentioned here that there's a rise of sentimental literature that went hand in hand with revolution. Mm-hmm. So we won't have time, unfortunately, to talk in substance about that because, but there are five more chapters and an epilogue that I want to make sure that we at least touch on, mm-hmm. but that's there.
Okay. Thank you.
Of course. So as we move from there to chapter three is going to look at the cultural representation of the ideal of enlightenment. So enlightenment's going to be a key term here. By looking at the youth discourse constructed by Chen Duxiu's New Youth, which began to be influential around the middle of the 1910s. Now, this was the leading youth magazine of the May 4th period, and you look here at the ways that the magazine and the New Culture Movement helped create a new identity for Chinese youths, right, New Youth. Now, what I want to ask you to talk just very briefly about is another kind of case study that you mentioned in this context, right? Just kind of given mm-hmm. the time we have, you talk about the Chinese Bildungsroman in this context as it's exemplified in a work called Ni Huanzhi, right? Ye Shangtao's Ni Huanzhi. Now, this was the first major Chinese novel to foreground what you call the formative experiences of modern youth, and it comes up all over the book. So I think it's important for us to have even a brief sense of the importance of this work. So for listeners who have never heard of this, can you talk very briefly about sort of what do we need to understand about this work and the importance of this work to understand the work that it's doing here in this chapter? What's the big deal, basically, about this work as a Bildungsroman?
Ni Huanzhi is when it was composed, it was named a novel of education. It was serialized in educational journal or educational magazine. So it was consciously written as a novel of education, and it's about the cultivation of a new youth character. It's the first of is kind of in the form of a long novel in terms of Western narrative. So I think the importance of this novel is really that it is groundbreaking. It's the novel that first established some of the major formats for the form of the Chinese Bildungsroman.
Great, thank you so much. And you talk about here the way the novel also embodies certain tensions, and this is really important, right? The tension between love and education, the tension for one character between being a lover and being a wife. There's all kinds of ways in which these there are tensions and frustrations that emerge through this Bildungsroman that really help us understand also not just this moment, but how the discursive figure of youth changes as we move forward into the story. And as we move forward, we move from this into a very different set of novels by a very different author. So chapter 4 takes us into a turn, or what you call a turn left in modern Chinese literature, in the midst of the changing political climate of the 1920s. So in this climate, this enlightened, I mentioned the importance of the figure of enlightenment, this enlightened new youth that we talked about briefly in the context of Ni Huanzhi was replaced by a revolutionary youth as the central literary figure of the period. And we see this by looking at the early novels of Mao Dun. Okay, so briefly put for us, what are some of, for you, the most important ways that these novels, and you talk about the Eclipse trilogy, and you talk about the unfinished novel Rainbow, what are some of the important ways that what's happening in these novels is differing from what was happening in Ni Huanzhi, and in some way that's important for understanding what you're arguing here?
In Ni Huanzhi, actually, I wrote about how Mao Dun received Ni Huanzhi and how he criticized Ni Huanzhi, because he found in Ni Huanzhi some sort of a subjectivism that he didn't think is in the line of the turn towards the left that happened in the 1920s. So for Mao Dun, I think the project is more ambitious than Ni Huanzhi. Ni Huanzhi mainly focuses on one individual character's self-development through education, love, and revolution. But for Mao Dun, did not just only want to write about individual youth. He also wanted to put the individual character's development in the larger context of a historical movement. He really combines the individual youth story with the story of the nation, or he tried to do that. So I think that is one important step toward establishing this, what I call the Chinese Bildungsroman, that represents the nation story through an individual story. But there are problems, there are gaps, there are quite a lot of ironies in that. In the cases of the Eclipse Trilogy and Rainbow, modern project never could be completed. There are simply the sensations, there are the feelings that cannot fit well into the project. So I think Maldon is really a very interesting writer. In his early novels, we already saw the really the rich implications about how the youth image can be depicted in this way and that way, and sometimes the conflicts within the narrative led to see Rimbaud's situation of being abandoned, couldn't move on, all into this sort of a sabotage of Maldon's original plan to make the three parts of the Eclipse trilogy a linear progress. But it cannot really be a linear project. It's a sort of a cut in different directions. So there's this ideal project for the Bildungsroman, but there are also this really concrete writing projects that cannot fulfill this ideal project of this novel. Yeah,
there's really cool stuff happening around issues of gender in this work. And so in addition to this really cool moment that you bring us into in the Eclipse trilogy, where you're talking about Mao Dun's use and invocation of the myth of goddesses of Northern Europe, right, used to kind of historicize mm-hmm. time, and this becomes bound up in his own personal relationship with this woman, and she becomes, you know, a way to think about this goddess figure. I mean, it's just really, really beautiful and fabulous. But what I want to also ask you about is what's happening in Rainbow. Now, you talk a lot about the narrative of Rainbow, the layout of Rainbow, but in particular, you describe Rainbow as a gendered revolutionary So that seems really important. And what's happening with figures of women here is really cool. So in what way, briefly put, is Rainbow a gendered revolutionary Bildungsroman? And why is that important?
It's a...
aside from being really cool, because it is
very cool. Thank you. I think the very interesting thing is that Maldon uses gender as a trope here to represent what is being written into it, what is to be disciplined, what is to be corrected. So the protagonist of Rainbow, Miss May, she's depicted as a woman character who is very much aware of her gender, but in the process of personal development, Maldon tries to make her constantly resistant to the idea of being a woman. So the femininity is constantly being surprised in order to meet the demands of this revolutionary education or apprenticeship. So that is something that is like gender is here put into a sort of like made into like a contested idea where the mandate of revolution conflicts with femininity, conflicts with the role of the gender or the self-conscious gender. Maldon actually, he's a naturalist. They claim to be a naturalist and also in some sense a realist. So by all means, he's a better writer, I think. He cannot give up a lot of details about the character. So eventually what emerged is this conflict between the gender awareness and the revolutionary mandate. So that is not to be easily solved. It's unlike what, if I can jump to a later chapter, what yeah. happens in the Song of Youth. The 青春之歌, that was written much later in the 1950s, in which gender is rendered as a, almost like a, something that the male revolutionaries constantly wrote something into, and Lin Daojing is, you know, that's sort of a, really like a, being disciplined, that sort of writing. But in modern's early novels, the situation is quite wild. It's beyond control. So that laid bare a lot of the tensions there in the narrative.
Mm-hmm. And I love this part of the book. And for listeners, the Song of Youth that you were mentioning, this is in chapter 7, and this is a work that is described here in this part of the book as a socialist Bildungsroman, promoting mm-hmm. correct modes of yeah. self-fashioning and ideological thinking. And it happens to be what you call the most influential Bildungsroman in the early PRC. So mm-hmm. listeners who are particularly interested in that contrast can go to chapter 7 and find that. Now, as we move forward, before we get there in the narrative, we first come to Bajin, the work of Bajin. Now, this is really fascinating. This is in chapter 5. Now, Bajin was an anarchist revolutionary, as you tell us here, before he became a novelist, and this is well known. His pen name came from, Bajin actually comes from renderings of Bakunin and Kropotkin, right?
Yeah.
And you take us here into his early anarchistic novels. You talk about Destruction, for example, which is sort of stimulated in part by the death of Sacco and Vanzetti. And Vanzetti was one of his mentors, right? And it's kind of a narrative of the life and death of an anarchist revolutionary. And it's really, really interesting. You also bring us into studies of new life, of the love trilogy, and of family. Now, you know, if we had another like 3 hours, I would want to hear all about every single bit. But given that we don't, I want to just highlight one of the what seems to be a really important point that comes out of your analysis of all of these works. And this is the importance of sacrifice. You talk here about a kind of melodramatic approach in Bajin's novels that, in the words of the book, turns the sacrifice of youth into an aestheticized process of the flowering of life. So can you talk here about the importance of sacrifice insofar as it's shaping what's happening with youth in your analysis of Bajin?
Bajin is famous for being a spokesman for the new youth. His characters like Gao Jiehui is definitely one of the most famous youth characters in modern Chinese literature. So the flowering of life is another very famous phrase coined by Bajin. It represents the most splendid image of a youth. So it's there's this glory, there's a sublime image of youth in Bajin's writing. But I want to point out that behind this image, or actually inside this image, there's a darker side. There's a side of about sacrifice, and it's the total consumption of youth for the revolutionary cause. So total demise of youth is the condition for the constructing of a more positive of image of youth. So that is something I feel is a very important aspect of Bajin's discourse and novelistic depiction of the young. And it's also this is also based on the sort of a moral accord that is underlined by the rivalry between the good and the evil. So Bajin associated the image of youth with the eternal goodness, and it is not in Liang Qichao or earlier advocates of the youth culture who invented this internal conflict between youth and age. It's rather Ba Jing who popularized this. But in this depiction of the battle between good and evil, between youth and age, this actually this constant depiction of the demise of youth, the sacrifice of youth for the higher end of a revolutionary cause. Mm-hmm. So that is something I wanted to see. Yeah.
Great. So once we move from here to chapter six actually brings us into the very different journey of Chinese youths after the Second Sino-Japanese War broke out in the summer mm-hmm. of 1937. Now, you tell us here that this was a wartime journey of exile or displacement, while youths of the May 4th period, which we turned to a little bit earlier in the book, journeyed to metropolitan centers that were celebrated as spaces of enlightenment. We talked a little bit about enlightenment before. These youths, in contrast, moved in the opposite direction. And the chapter talks about this as a journey to interiority. Now, the chapter looks at two novels in particular that both converge on a theme that the chapter calls the youth's self-fashioning against institutional interventions, and a personal mm-hmm. development as a kind of journey to find the inner self. Both of these are products that stand somewhat outside the mainstream of wartime culture. This one is a novel called Children of the Rich, and the other is a novel called The Everlasting Song. Now, in the brief time that we have, we won't have time to talk in detail about everything that's going here, but if you had to choose what you think is of the most important takeaway here, or what you are most excited about that's happening in this chapter, chapter six, what would that be?
The wartime is actually a time when the main theme of the resistance, the main theme of patriotism that dominated Chinese literature. These two novels are sort of very different. They are actually, if you look at the history of these two novels, or the critical reception of these two novels in Chinese literature, they are very much marginalized. They have impact on later writers, but sort of they are not they are overlooked. They tend to be overlooked because they are not part of the main movement of the resistance. But I appreciate this sort of difference in these two novels, particularly because they showcase the tendency of resisting this main theme about resistance. So in both novels, there's this emphasis on the construction of a more lyrical, subjective inner self that is not to be contained by the external demands of either the nation or the party, or in the case of the Everlasting Song, the very much like the institution of higher education, where liberty is being emphasized. It's like a liberal arts education, but the novel tries to show even the very liberal atmosphere of such a college could be sort of like a containment for the young character. So there's this this self-conscious of the young who want to be free of any of these external confinement. So I think that is particularly valuable in the at the time when this epic sort of a theme of the war going on.
Mm-hmm. Now, the next chapter actually pulls us forward from this, and thank you for that, into two more novels that also are written in response to communist discourse on youth and are novels of the early PRC period, and that have very different approaches and very different styles. We've already talked briefly about one of them. This is The Song of Youth, and this is the socialist Bildungsroman that we talked about a little bit earlier in contradistinction to one of the earlier novels. But the other one is also really interesting. This is Wang Meng's book, Long Live Youth. And you talk about this as a work that challenges the generic definition of the Bildungsroman. You say here it breaks down the idea of a linear narrative, of a step-by-step narrative of personal growth, and instead depicts the restlessness, the feelings, the ecstatic feelings of the protagonist's life. There's this really interesting stuff happening here with the inner life of a girl who, as you put it here, is stirred by her own adolescence, and other really interesting gender stuff happening here. So for you, what's most interesting and important, perhaps, about this novel, Long Live Youth, and the way it's kind of disrupting what we think of here as the Bildungsroman and its creation of youth?
I think The Song of Youth is really the culmination of the development of the genre. When we compare it with Mao Dun's Rainbow, we see almost everything is being rewritten according to the political correctness here. So it's no wonder the Mao Dun praised the Song of Youth as one of his favorite novels coming from 1950s. It's sort of like a corruption of, not corruption, correction of Mao Dun's earlier idea about the development of a young character in the background of the national sort of a rejuvenation. So that creates what we may see as a so-called positive image of the young. But basically, at the same time, I think it's a more important trend that is beginning to be formed, that is represented by Wang Meng's Long Live Youth, that is to make youth no longer the subject of being corrected or being disciplined or being tamed. It's really about the young who take for granted their self-corrective role as a youth. They are the master of the new society. So they take for granted their power, their dynamism that is like a forever alive, that is forever energetic. So that is something I would not see like a subversive, but it indeed is different from what the youth discourse of the Mao time emphasized. It's sort of trying to create the image of youth that is really the nation. So it's like to see Liang Qichao's dream for the young China being being realized, coming true. This sort of a writing, but in this very sense, the Bildungsroman is no longer the narrative form that is sort of like the vehicle to present these ideas. So so there's this Long Live Youth is like the counter Bildungsroman that eventually showcases the power of youth as the cause of developmental story.
And it's got a really weird ending where Chairman Mao is all of a sudden in the picture.
Right.
There's like really right. weird stuff. And So I highly recommend listeners, as you work through the book, like pay special attention to what's going on here in chapter 7. And like, this is also a chance for me to just mention that, you know, we've been talking in these relatively large diachronic terms, but there's so much really detailed and fascinating and sensitive and just really exciting detail that brings these stories to life in the book. It's a very rich narrative. And so for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read it, I just want to make sure that that's clear. Like, all of these stories have characters and feelings and textures and really interesting things that happen. And then one guy's brain opens up, and it's just really cool. And you'll find all of that in these pages. And even though we don't have 3 hours to talk about all of that stuff, this is one of many, many cases in which there's like, you know, in the margins of my book, I'm like, what? I have, you know, WTF, what is Mao doing here? And so there's a lot of really, really interesting detail there too. Okay, so speaking of interesting detail, I'm not going to bring us to the conclusion until we have a chance to talk briefly about the epilogue. Now, the epilogue briefly discusses, as you put it here, popular youth images in contemporary Chinese literature. And it brings us into a short story by a Chinese science fiction writer that's becoming more and more popular since at least two of the three books in the trilogy have been published. This is Liu Cixin, whose three-body problem has just, you know, gone crazy. It's like gangbusters. All of us are reading it. It's great. Dark Forest came out in translation. We're all waiting for the third one so we can teach it and read it. So this is a really exciting Chinese science fiction writer. And you bring us here as a way to conclude the book into not the three-body problem, right? Not Dark Forest, but instead into a story called Micro Era. And you talk about the ways that this story has reappropriated and transformed this dream of Liang Qichao that we began the conversation with. So I think this is a good place to bring us to our conclusion. So Mingwei, what's going on in this story, Micro Era? Why is it important, and how does it kind of bring this story to a close for you?
Actually, this epilogue, it really sort of brought me back to where I begin. It's actually 1999, the time when I begin to think about the meaning of youth in contemporary Chinese culture, in modern Chinese culture. I think it's important if I can write another book, is perhaps going to cover what happened between Wang Meng's novel and then 1999. But that's very complicated. That's really some project that right now I do not want to take. But to think about these ideas, it's still very exciting because there's a sort of a contrast with the beginning. At the beginning, it's like when the reformers created and instituted the image of youth, they invested a lot of values in this symbolic trope. It's like over invested. It's used to refer to a lot of things, but in the contemporary, there's this so-called youth fiction, qingchunxiaoshi. For the first time, this is the fiction that claims to be about youth. I actually think Wang Meng's Qingchun Wansui is really the beginning of this trend, although it stretches really long from the 1950s to the scientific, to the end of the century literary scene. In this new trend, there's this void, this emptiness, that is what I I'd like to use Liu Xin's story to highlight, because in this imaginative work, Liu Xin could envision a world where they're only youth, they're only young people, but they're this world is like a utopian. This world is like a paradise because they do not have any memory. They do not have any sort of sorrows or sadness. It's kind of like impossible word to think of. But I think just a few years later, when this 青春小说 began to pick up momentum, we actually see we actually found in a lot of these youth literature, youth fiction, the similar emptiness, the similar kind of void of any meaning, of any symbolic meaning. It's kind of like the youth is no longer part of this discourse. I don't know. It's sort of like a youth is already liberated from this symbolism, political symbolism, or it is actually now underlined by consumerism, by a new sort of culture characterization. Mm-hmm. So,
thank you so much, and I think you bring us by the end of this book, and the end of the epilogue, to a point that I think underlines what you've just said. Every utopia is at the same time dystopian. And the book ends, not as the last sentence, but really on the last pages, with a question that I'll also leave us with as we move to our conclusion. Who are we? How are we constructed as youth? So I think all of this ultimately kind of comes full circle, and it asks us to not just think about, as we talked about at the beginning of our conversation, what is youth? What does it mean to talk about youth? But then by the end of the book, after we've traveled with you through all of these journeys and all of these books and all of these stories, we're able to not just ask that question, but self-reflect and think, you know, not just what is youth, but who are we as youths? So Mingwei, there's so much, right, that we could talk about that we haven't had time for, and we've alluded to some of that along the way. But now that we've come to our conclusion, is there anything in particular that didn't come up but that you'd like to leave our listeners with, and perhaps in particular listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book?
I think it's very much what you talked about, you asked. It's about all the main aspects of the book. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Oh, of course. So now, Mingwei, now that the book is out, and congratulations, I think if it's not
Thank
obvious,
you.
It's an extraordinarily rich book, and there's so much here. What's next for you? What are you currently working on and inspired by?
I actually, when I begin to when I was halfway through the work on the book project, I found there's a sort of something very interesting when I was writing. It's actually when I wrote about this youth image, a lot of it has something to do with utopian, with the image of the future. So I wrote about the new story of Stone. The second half of it, it's a utopian fiction or science fiction, because it does depict various techniques in the future world, and I ended the book with Liu Cixin's science fiction story, Macro Era. So sort of, growing up from this project is my current project on Chinese science fiction. And I began to work on this when I write a lot about Liu Cixin, when I write his novels, his short stories. I felt very excited about this new development of Chinese literature in the popular genre. So I first wrote about the utopian, dystopian sort of variations, and recently I moved on to write about the human, post-human variations, and also the very idea of the future in contemporary Chinese science fiction. So that is something I'm doing, and I feel very excited about it. And hopefully I will share with the reader something in the future.
Yay! I'm so excited you're working on that. So we are definitely talking about that book when that's done too. That's really exciting. Okay. But in the meantime, thank you so much, Minghui, for taking time away from that and to talk with me about this book. This is also a really exciting book, and I'm really grateful to you for taking the time to talk about it. So thanks very, very much.
Thank you, Kara. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.